Before you listen to this episode, just a quick word on a PTO live event. On the 16th of May in London, Gargi Bhattacharya and Richard Seymour will be in conversation with me on the topic of disaster nationalism, racial capitalism, and the crisis of the liberal international order. We'll be talking about the root causes of the rise of the far right, how the left should respond, and whether what we are seeing is the emergence of a 21st century iteration of fascism. The event is free and will be taking place on the evening of the 16th of May at Space 4 in Finsbury Park, North London. You'll find a link to book your spot at the event in the description of today's episode. It'll be wonderful to see lots of you there. Hello and welcome to another episode of Politics Theory Other. In today's episode, I spoke to international security expert Paul Rogers about Iran's attack on Israel on the 13th of April, the first such direct operation carried out by Iran, itself launched in response to Israel's attack on the Iranian consulate building in Damascus. We discussed whether the operation was a failure or a qualified success, and the role of the United States, Britain, France and Jordan in the downing of Iranian missiles and drones. We also talked about the progress of Iran's nuclear weapons program and how the attacks on the 13th may have distracted attention from the IDF's failure to defeat Hamas in Gaza. Paul Rogers is Emeritus Professor of Peace Studies in the Department of Peace Studies and International Relations at Bradford University, and he is the International Security Correspondent for Open Democracy. The interview was recorded prior to Israel's retaliatory strikes on Iran, and so yesterday I got Paul on the phone again to give his thoughts on Israel's response. I began by asking him what he makes of the nature of the attacks Israel carried out, and whether the apparently limited nature of the operation provides an off-ramp from the cycle of escalation.
As to the nature, it's actually very difficult to say. The Israelis have basically revealed very little, and for very different reasons, so have the Iranians. It seems to have been that there were strikes, particularly on one or two cities with loose connections to the nuclear program, but these were frankly minor, and the Iranians are trying to make out that it was all internal. I'm sure that was not the case. The indications are that there were some drones or other sort of standoff missiles launched from aircraft, not over Iranian territory, but aimed at targets within Iran. But these were really minor in nature, and as I say, the Iranians are actually saying very little about them. It's almost as though there's an agreement on both sides that they do not want to escalate. And if that is the case, that in the short term, at least, there's an opportunity to avoid any kind of sort of breakout of greater violence. Difficult to say because of the complications of the various militias operating, for example, in Syria and Iraq. And of course, there's Hezbollah in Lebanon as well. But for the moment, I think things have cooled somewhat, to many people's surprise. And there's a lot we do not know about what has happened in the last couple of weeks. And there are indications that the Iranian attack on Israel, which was reported to be a complete failure, was not a complete failure. And in fact, the Iranians got a lot out of how the Israelis were able to defend themselves than they were let on. But that's difficult to say at the moment. For the moment, at least, things are easier.
Do you think the nature of Israel's operation against Iran, do you think that indicates that they are not about to carry out another attack of the kind that led to the Iranian operation against Israel, the attack on the Iranian consulate in Damascus, that we probably won't see something like that because it's hard to see how Iran wouldn't have to respond pretty heavily to a similar operation. And therefore, we may have seen a degree of deterrence restored and that there may be at least something of a period of calm.
I think there probably will be something of a period of calm in relation to Israeli-Iranian relations. Always remember, though, that acronym, AIM, Accidents, Incidents and Mavericks. You can never be sure when something may not break out, which might not even be planned by either side. Having said that, I think things have eased rather. And in many ways, I think Netanyahu will have been pleased with what has happened, in that this has been a massive diversion from his main issue, which, of course, is what is going on in Gaza and increasingly on the occupied West Bank. So to that extent, I think their eyes will be focused, refocused very strongly on what's happening within the West Bank and Gaza.
The following is the interview I recorded with Paul prior to Israel's attacks on the 18th of April. So, Paul, before we go into the broader ramifications of Iran's attack on Israel, the first ever such operation by Iran, what are your thoughts on the extent to which the operation was a success? Because we've seen conflicting views on that. Some have argued that given that the overwhelming majority of Iran's drones and missiles were downed by Israel and its allies, that the operation was therefore an abject failure, and that even if this was merely a shot across Israel's bows, rather than an attempt to inflict very serious damage, nonetheless, the Iranians would still have wanted to cause more material destruction than was the case. On the other side of that argument, some have suggested that by striking Israel directly, Iran has restored a measure of deterrence by raising the threat of future direct attacks if Israel persists in trying to degrade Iran's forces in Syria and elsewhere in the region. What's your view? Was this a failure for the Iranians or a success, even if only a partial one?
I suspect it was probably something of a success. Immediately after the raids, we were told that no Iranian drones or missiles had crossed into Israeli airspace. We know that's wrong because one of the bases that was under attack was actually attacked. We've seen footage since then of bits of missiles in different parts of Israel. So I think one's got to allow for, you know, truth being a casualty in war. I think that given that the Iranians have thousands and thousands of a range of different missiles, that this was actually calibrated in a rather particular way. One thing to remember is that this was closely coordinated. There were a lot of firings from Iran, but there were also firings coordinated from Iraq, from Syria, and even from Yemen, and it possibly even via Hezbollah from essentially from southern Lebanon. So I think it was actually something of a test run for the Iranians just to see what the Israeli forces were like, the defense forces. And remember, very considerable warnings were given. People knew it was coming. And so to that extent, I think there's much more of a demonstration shot, the implication being that they could do far more if they tried. And I think I would tend to go with that myself.
And I suppose on the point about Hezbollah, if we saw a really large-scale war between Iran and Israel, it wouldn't be simply between the two countries, and therefore it's a mistake to just compare the forces available to each, because Iran would go into battle with Hezbollah and its other allies with all their hybrid asymmetric capabilities, right?
Yes, right.
On Monday, The Intercept reported that a majority of the drones and missiles fired by Iran were actually downed by US forces rather than by Israel and its much vaunted Iron Dome system. Can you talk a bit about the role that the US, Britain, France and pro-US states in the region, such as Jordan and possibly Saudi Arabia, played in the response, which took down at least some of these weapons before they reached Israeli airspace?
Again, the information is coming in dribs and drabs, and one has to be cautious about how accurate it is. I suspect that the United States was pretty significant. It's worth remembering that there is an advanced X-band radar site within Israel, which is constantly crewed by full-time US service people. And that particular facility is designed for long-range checks. Essentially, it's the kind of system which goes into the Israeli system, but is basically for the Americans. But I don't think people realize there are troops now, American troops permanently based in Israel, and that is their function. So I think the US probably had a much bigger role than they're letting on. I think the British and the French was really symbolic. The Jordanians, less so, but of course, the stuff was going over their airspace. And one suspects there may have been a connection with Saudi Arabia, but that's very difficult to say. So overall, yes, the United States would have been highly significant, but we have to remember that advanced radar facility, which is part of their whole coverage of the Middle East.
Do you see the involvement of the United States and other Israeli allies as straightforwardly a positive for Israel? I mean, you know, clearly it gives them capabilities that they wouldn't have on their own, but does it suggest for the Israelis a worrying degree of dependency, and particularly in a context where support for Israel amongst Democrat voters is declining, and so it's possible that at some point in the future we might see a shift on that side. But also, Trump is notoriously mercurial and has said very conflicting things about Israel. And he always takes a very sort of transactional approach to US allies. And so it's not clear that if he became president, that Israel could depend on the US in the same way.
That's certainly true. And I think the Israelis recognize this. But if you look at it in another way, 2 weeks ago, Israel was close to being considered a pariah or rogue state, not just in the Middle East. I mean, even through to Western countries, and a lot of criticism of Israel coming from Biden, and much stronger rhetoric. It didn't go beyond rhetoric, but it was strong rhetoric. You had the anomaly of the Americans building a temporary port to get aid into Gaza while still providing the Israelis with loads of bombs to kill the Palestinians. But that essentially is just this crazy situation we're in now. But I think the point about this is that the Israelis are really in a much better position as far as the Americans are concerned than they were 2 weeks ago. And so for that, I think, is enough for Netanyahu. But the problem with that is that for Netanyahu's position, he would want this conflict with Iran to continue for as long as possible, not necessarily in open warfare, but making a huge, digression from what his main problem is. And on that basis, I think it's gone quite well for him. But I acknowledge what you say about the problems that there are on just how capable the Israeli defences are.
So this might be a case where the interests of Netanyahu and the interests of the Israeli state and the Israeli military diverge significantly.
It may be, but don't forget that the senior Israeli and military, particularly the top people, those two key people in the war cabinet, they want a war in some ways because it was such a disaster for the IDF on 7th of October that they really need to reestablish their position as a prime military force. That's a pretty dangerous position to be in. But so to that extent, Netanyahu and the most senior IDF people would want this sort of tension to continue.
Going back to the Iranian attack on Israel, so clearly much of the success that Israel and its allies had in downing the missiles and the drones is attributable to the fact that the operation was, as you say, very heavily telegraphed in advance. But also, of course, this was a one-time affair. And we've seen, for instance, in Ukraine, that Russia's drone and missile attacks have been increasingly effective in penetrating Ukrainian air defences over a much longer period of time. Do you think the Ukraine war is that relevant? Do you see useful parallels between the two?
I think it's just relevant in two ways. One is that many of the missiles, particularly the cheaper drones, have been supplied by Iran to Russia. And so the Iranian people relevant to this will have been studying very closely how they worked in Ukraine, and they got a lot out of that. But secondly, it comes back to the other point that if this was a pretty grim trial run, then the Iranians will have learned a lot from it, and they will marry that in with what they know about how these systems work in Ukraine. So to that extent, I think it puts the Iranians in a relatively stronger position vis-a-vis essentially their relationships with Israel. Whether the Israelis accept that is very difficult to say, though.
You've already touched on the way in which Iran's attack on Israel has distracted attention from the Gaza war and the IDF's failure to defeat Hamas. How dramatic has that failure been, in your opinion, and what's your sense of the forces that are still at the disposal of the Hamas military leadership in Gaza, and also where they're currently operating?
Well, it's worth remembering that Hamas itself has taken a huge number of casualties itself. But on the other hand, the war is still going on. I mean, there have been, 60 people killed and 90 injured on the Palestinian side in the last 24 hours. And all that is off the headlines. The totals are now 34,000 killed, 77,000 injured, and that's not allowing for all the people who are buried under the rubble. So it continues. And again, you have the huge problem with aid distribution, not least because the Israelis are trying to sideline any work by the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA. But this is part of, as we know, the Dahir doctrine. You know, if you can't actually defeat an insurgency, then you damage the people you believe are supporting it. So I think Hamas is damaged. But from what you were just saying, I mean, Hamas is back operating in northern and central Gaza. Not major by any means. But, you know, we were told 3 months ago that the Israelis had cleared those areas completely of Hamas.
Do you think the fact that we haven't seen
an immediate response from Israel indicates that they've been restrained by the Americans and that, in effect, any Israeli counterattack will have to be greenlit by the Biden administration, even if Netanyahu claims that Israel will respond as it sees fit.
First of all, I think under Netanyahu, Israel will tend to go its own way if pushed too far. I don't think it'll bow to US pressure unless there's very strong pressure, including threatened withdrawal of arms supplies. That, I think, is the reality given Netanyahu. One's got to remember he is very unpopular in Israel for a range of other reasons. But the point is the war is still very popular. And if that includes basically trying to destroy Hamas in Gaza and elsewhere, it also includes Iran more generally. So I think he feels he can go a long way. And essentially, if there are problems with the United States, they will tend to go away, not least because he still does have a lot of support. One has the whole of the Christian Zionist faction, which is very significant in American politics, on this one issue. So I think essentially he still is his own person. But at some stage, even Biden will probably say enough is enough. But I don't see we're there yet, because, of course, the Americans take a very different view of Iran from the typical view in the United Kingdom. We tend to forget that, I think.
The next question, I'm afraid, it's a bit of a hostage to fortune, this one. But what do you see as the most likely Israeli response to Saturday's attacks? I mean, it's been suggested that Israel might carry out just another operation like its attack on Iran's consulate in Damascus on April 1st, just to demonstrate that they will not be deterred from continuing to attrite Iran's forces in the region. Others have suggested a major covert assassination operation of the sort that we saw regarding Iran's nuclear program, or direct airstrikes against Iran, perhaps the most dramatic option, using Israel's fleet of F-15s and the F-35s and possibly even its Jericho 3 missiles. What do you see as the most likely response, and what sort of considerations do the Israelis have to balance in deciding upon one of those options?
Well, obviously, they could do something symbolic, which would be an attack on some target within Iran. But from their point of view, is that enough, given the range of different systems which Iran used to try and get through to Israel? They could go for a regional Revolutionary Guard center, not in Iran, but somewhere else in the region, and really destroy that. They could go for some sort of major cyber attack. But if they did a really big cyber attack, that will be telling the Iranians, you know, how good their cyber attack system is. They could certainly go for a major series of attacks in Iran, particularly on Revolutionary Guard centers. And the big one, of course, is they could do a strike against Iranian nuclear facilities. They couldn't destroy the deep underground bunkers that these Iranians bought in just a year or so ago, but they could do a lot of damage to all the other stuff which relates to that. I think there is a risk of that, actually. I think there is a risk that they will go for some support for the nuclear facilities. One's got to remember that Iran already has about, I think it's 160 kilos of pretty high enriched uranium, 60%. And once you get to that level of enrichment, it's not so difficult and not so long to get it up to 90%, which is more weapons grade. So in other words, the Iranians could probably have enough weapons-grade uranium within 2 or 3 months if they really pushed it. And then the question was, well, could they even detonate it? But it's at that level. The one risk is that if you go for major attacks across Iran as a whole, not necessarily related to the nuclear facilities, the Iranians would hunker down and develop nuclear forces as quickly as they could. Because that, I think, has always been their plan, not to develop nuclear weapons. But if push comes to shove, then everything changes. And I think that is the real risk we have at present, particularly with somebody like Netanyahu in charge. One mustn't over-egg the pudding on this, but I think myself there is a risk of that.
Do you see the technical difficulty as being more a credible delivery system rather than actually the ability to carry out a nuclear detonation?
Probably, yes. It's difficult to know. But I mean, Iran has so many different capabilities in different areas in the Middle East, that maybe they could do it in an indirect way. But in terms of delivering a bomb on an aircraft and hitting somewhere in Israel, no, but that's not really the point. It all changes if they detonate even a small device deep underground. And then you don't know where you are. It's very. This is where the symbols come in a lot, and I think this is where, if you do find that sometime in the next year or so, this sort of crisis continues and possibly even magnifies, then we may get to the point where Iran will just go hell for leather to have the capability to show they could develop nuclear weapons in a major way. And that capability could be expressed simply in just, you know, a 2 or 3 kiloton deep underground bunker explosion. That's the kind of thing. Now, we're getting into really difficult ground here, and you can't be sure. But I do worry a bit because of the nature of the Netanyahu regime and the move to the right of Israeli politics over the last 20 years. It really is something which I don't think we've really factored in enough to what's going on.
Could you say something on Israel's nuclear capability, which of course is neither confirmed nor denied by Israeli politicians or state functionaries, but of course we all know it exists?
As far as Israel's nuclear forces are concerned, they seem to be developed in the latter half of the 1960s and to have been available probably for use by the time of the Yom Kippur-Ramadan War in 1973. The word is that they may have had just a small handful of operational devices by then. They now seem, according to analysts who really know their stuff, they probably have something like 100 warheads of different forms. They may possibly include neutron warheads. They will certainly include thermonuclear stuff, but that doesn't mean they're absolutely massive. And as far as we can tell, this has all been produced largely at home, but certainly with aid from the French in the 1950s and indirectly from the Americans and possibly the British ever since. As far as delivery systems are concerned, they have the series of Jericho missiles. Then you have the F-15E, possibly the F-15I, possibly the F-16I, and certainly the new F-35 is meant to be nuclear capable. It's possible that one or two of their submarines have cruise missiles which are nuclear tipped. So they have a variety of capabilities, and they don't really make much secret of this, at least unofficially.
All right, my last question then, Paul. What's your sense of how Russia and China view the current situation and this dramatic escalation? Do their positions differ much, given that China is a major buyer of Iranian oil?
Well, China would not like to see a huge surge in oil prices, although it would affect the Western world more. Whereas for Russia, it wouldn't matter too much because of its domestic resources. I think there are going to be mixed messages. Anything which can be seen as bad for the United States can be seen as good for Russia and to a fair extent for China as well, but perhaps not so much for China because it's more conscious of the way that things can get out of hand and backfire on it. So I think the kind of situation we're in now is watching with interest. I put it even that way. And essentially, you know, since this is clearly difficult for Biden and difficult for the United States and the West, then certainly Moscow will be happy with that. I'm not quite so sure that Beijing will be as happy as Moscow.
You've been listening to Politics Theory Other. If you've been enjoying PTO and finding it useful, please do consider rating or reviewing the show on Apple Podcasts. It really does help to bring in new listeners. The show's music and graphic design is produced by Planet B Productions. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week.